This is the Commodity Culture Podcast, where we interview prominent investors, fund managers, analysts, and company CEOs to give you an edge when it comes to investing in the commodity space. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Commodity Culture, where our goal is to make you a better investor in the commodity space. My name is Jesse Day. Before we dive in, standard disclaimer, nothing here is investment advice. Do your own due diligence. And today's guest is the CEO of Sprott Asset Management and the senior managing partner of Sprott Inc. He is responsible for overseeing Sprott's public market investment strategies and is also the portfolio manager for the company's physical commodity funds. We're going to be discussing uranium, gold, silver, copper, and more today. It's John Champaglia. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be back. That's quite a roster of medals to cover. I'm excited.
Yes, I'm excited as well. But before we do dive into those metals, I want to start with your views on the current state of the broad market and economy. I'm wondering what trends and themes you're watching right now that you think investors should be paying attention to.
Yeah, well, it's been kind of an unusual, I would say, couple of years with most markets. And that's just because central banks around the world have had a disproportionate influence on the valuations of everything from real estate to bonds to stocks to precious metals. And that's really because of the pivot. We've gone from a period of hyper easy money. Obviously, that was spurred on by the COVID-19 pandemic, and then shifting to an era of tightening, which we saw unprecedented increases in interest rates. And I think it's important for people to realize that when you shift interest rates as dramatically as central banks around the world have done, that has an incredible impact on the valuations of assets, particularly long duration assets. And we've seen obviously huge unrealized losses in the bond market as interest rates have gone from basically zero to, 4 or 5% or more. We've had an incredible impact on real estate values, in particular commercial real estate values, which is obviously having a ripple effect through, bank loan books and things like that, which have led to some bank failures. Stocks, it's been kind of an odd market in terms of, technology stocks after having a soft 2022, really were huge winners last year. And we're starting to see some, I think, improvement in breadth of stock market leadership, but it's been a very narrow group of stocks. And then on the commodity front, we've obviously had a real mixed bag in terms of things like uranium being big winners last year, gold and silver kind of perking up and waking up after being in the doldrums for a while. And a lot of the battery metals, and I'd say more traditional industrial metals like iron ore have struggled. Whereas metals related to energy transition like copper have kind of decoupled from their more, traditional group that they move with, like iron, which we can talk about. So, it's the reason why I've been in the business for 30 years. There's never a dull moment. Markets are so dynamic. There's always things going on. There's always things to learn. And I'm very intellectual curious. So, I never stop reading and watching markets.
Yeah, no, I'm right there with you. That's why I love doing the show and talking to so many experts like yourself, getting different opinions, different insights into both the market in general, as well as commodities. You mentioned uranium there. I'd like to touch on that next. A formidable performance last year. I believe it was the best performing commodity on a percentage gain basis. Also performing well in 2024. Obviously, we saw a bit of a dip in the spot market after it hit around $100. But I think that's to be expected. The big news in the sector is basically Kazatomprom announcing that they've missed production targets for 2023 and expect to miss in 2024 and 2025, possibly even forcing them to purchase pounds on the spot market to fulfill contracts. I wonder what your thoughts are on that news. Do you think it changes the supply-demand dynamics of the market and kind of the thesis moving forward?
Yeah, so you bring up a really important part of the uranium story, and the reason for that is quite simple. Kazakhstan is the largest producer of uranium in the world with a little over 40% of world production. So they basically are the equivalent of OPEC in terms of uranium supply. So as you, because of that, the world watches them very closely in terms of what their plans are, what their production profile will look like. And obviously, with the price of uranium going from the low 20s per pound 3 years ago up to through $100 recently, the world obviously is waiting for, as you would expect, a supply response. And that basically happens with every commodity bull market. As the price rises, it allows more and more deposits become economic. It allows companies to raise capital and actually bring production online. And that's, you know, obviously very rational economic behavior. So when you have the world's largest producer and also the lowest cost producer because of the type of mining that they do, and I'm not going to use the word mining, but basically they don't do traditional underground or open pit mining for uranium. They do something called in situ leaching, which is basically a technique where they inject different chemicals into the ground and they basically leach the uranium out of the soil and then pump it back to surface and separate it. It's a very different technique than you know what hard rock mining most people think of. So they have a very low cost structure. And in the last cycle, Kazakhstan, you know, went from becoming a fairly small player on the world stage in terms of uranium production, producing about 5 million pounds a year. And they ultimately ramped up production to 60 million pounds a year. And because they've had the ability to ramp up production to that kind of scale, everyone watches what they are going to do next. And for the last few years, they've been on a model of supply discipline, which basically means they, along with other companies like Cameco, have essentially curtailed production because of sub-economic pricing. Now, last September, I'm going to start the story there, because when the price hit $72 a pound after kind of breaking out from the mid-50s, Kazatomprom announced that they were going to increase production in 2024 by about 8 million extra pounds, and in 2025 by about 16 million extra pounds. And that would basically bring them back to their subsoil licensed capacity. And the world went, wow, okay, they're flexing up. The signals, you know, the price signals are there, the demand signals are there, and they're responding. So that was at the end of September. Now, the price fell $5 a pound shortly after that news, from 72 to 67. And about a week later, the price went back to 72 and just kept on going up to 91 at the end of the year. And I think the reason why it shook the news off was there was a very high level of skepticism whether they will actually do it or able to do it. Now, sure enough, we get to January or so of this year and they announced, well, no, there's going to be a change in production. And they ultimately told us in February that production for 2024 is essentially going to be flat. And they are no longer telling us what the plan is for 2025 until August of this year. So this is really important because, you know, while 8 million pounds this year and 16 the next are meaningful, I think it really is a powerful signal around what's really going on here. Now, the original messaging we heard from them was we have a sulfuric acid shortage in country. And remember, that's the chemical I referenced earlier that they need to inject into the ground to leach and to dissolve the uranium. They said there's a shortage and they were going to build a new plant in country. And that is still several years away. But more recently, and I listened to them on a conference I participated in just last week with the Bank of America, their messaging has completely changed. It's not a shortage of sulfuric acid. It's now a new strategy, which is value over volume, which is another way of saying we're gonna hold back our production and we're gonna try to maximize the value we get for the production we actually deliver to the market. This is really interesting. So I like to think of it as heads you win, tails you win, meaning whether it's a sulfuric acid issue or whether they're just deciding to curtail production, I think net net, we get the same outcome, which is we're not seeing a flood of supply response, even with the price of uranium being at $90 in the spot market and term prices having contract ceilings in the $120, $130 range. And I think that's really important because what that means is that the bull market will inevitably, in our opinion, play out for longer. And that's exactly what the industry needs. It needs a long, protracted bull market in order to incentivize the capital expenditures that will be needed in order to meet the growing supply required. And this is really important because we don't see where a meaningful supply response is going to come for the next 4 to 6 years. And how we come up with 4 to 6 years is quite simple. If you think about new greenfield production, so those are new mines, there are a number of very, I think, compelling projects that are going to be built in the cycle, but they haven't been built and they obviously have long lead times. If you think about the scenario of, okay, let's assume it is a sulfuric acid shortage issue in Kazakhstan. Well, we know from previous in history that it's taken them in one case 6 years to build a new sulfuric acid plant. So let's just assume they build the plant in 4 years, and then they take time to drill and inject and leach. So you're talking about 5 years potentially of meaningful new supply coming from Kazakhstan, assuming they need the additional acid. So I think in those two scenarios, we think the bull market is not going to see a meaningful supply response other than all the brownfields that are obviously well underway to restarting, which has been very helpful for the mining stocks.
Yeah, very thorough and interesting breakdown there. And, you know, it's interesting. We've also seen in Niger some issues there with the coup and with the situation with the government. That's become murky on how that supply is going to for this cycle, it will be able to come online. People are watching that very closely. And you've got some projects in the Athabasca Basin that are moving towards production, but it's not 100% clear exactly when those are coming online. So I definitely hear what you're saying there about the potential tightness in the supply at the moment. Talk to us about the activity you're seeing in the uranium spot market right now through the lens of the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. How easy or difficult is it to secure pounds at the moment? And if you could also shed some light on any plans for the Physical Uranium Trust for the remainder of this year, that would be great too.
So the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust obviously has been a very important player in the physical uranium market over the last 2.5 years. And that's just because we've raised a lot of capital. We've taken that capital and we've purchased about 46 million pounds of U308. Since the summer of 2021. So, you know, we've obviously purchased a lot of uranium that really didn't have a home. Utilities didn't want to buy it. It was basically sitting with a lot of traders, a lot of hedge funds, other financial intermediaries. And over the last, almost 3 years, we've been active in the market. Now, when we started buying uranium in 2021 and 2022, there was a lot of material available because the price was, sub $30 for a very long time. Utilities were purchasing uranium under long-term contracts. That was about half of the replacement rate contracting level. So let's just, give you a very simple kind of a scenario to illustrate this. Let's say you need 180 million pounds of uranium to run your industry every year, but you're only buying 70 million per year. And you say, well, how do you function if you need 180 and you're only buying 70? Well, the answer is you had inventories on hand and you had excessive inventories on hand. And secondarily, you also believed, because it was the reality, that there was always a lot of material available for sale because there were pounds with no homes. There were pounds with no homes because reactors were closing down. They were coming to end of life. Some countries were in a state of decommissioning what they had. Other countries had turned off many of their reactors, such as Japan. And so there was a real overhang of material that was available. So from a utility perspective, there was no urgency. There's no urgency to buy in the term market, no urgency to buy in the spot market. And that, I think, ultimately led to the price, basically meandering around $20 to $28 for a number of years. Now, that obviously has changed dramatically, and that's because energy policies have shifted back in favor of nuclear power, and we've worked through a lot of that supply overhang. So when we were buying uranium in 21 and 22, we we're purchasing uranium from many different counterparties, and we could on any given day, you know, make a bunch of phone calls and reach out to a bunch of people around the world. And sure, we could piece together, you know, 1 million pounds on any given day. Those days are gone. That is not feasible anymore. And that's just because, one, utilities are back and contracting under long-term arrangements, back to replacement rate contracting, we believe, or close to it. And so they're back in the market, buying in the term market. They're nibbling around at times in the spot market. A lot of the material that had no home has been, I think, sequestered in our vehicle and other vehicles, and as well as some of the junior uranium miners, which have purchased material. So a lot of that secondary supply that was sloshing around is no longer available. And then finally, the Japanese. I mean, obviously, if you didn't think your reactor was ever going to come back online, why would you want to keep this material that you've had on your books for 10 years? But with a growing number of reactors getting permission to turn on, I think it's fair to say the mobility of that inventory has dissipated over the last year and a half. And so the market is a lot tighter. Now, what we see in the market is that the price has obviously had a huge move here from $60 a pound last September. We hit kind of $106 in the spot market in early part of 2024. At that point, we definitely saw a bit of a stall in the price. And the reason I think is simple. We had a bit of a buyer strike. I like to think of it as people that did not have urgency to buy because they don't. Remember, utilities have inventory. They don't have to panic. They don't have to knee-jerk react, and they don't need to chase the price higher. I think as the price broke $100, a lot of utilities and other players went, whoa, like we just had a $40 move here in 4 months. We are stepping back. We are not going to chase this. We're not going to push it any higher. Clearly, the market's become tighter. But that doesn't mean they've left the market. What that means is they've pivoted to the term market, and the term market has moved up $40 to $50 in terms of its band. So we've seen a commensurate move in pricing in the term market, and we've seen significant activity year to date in the term market with lots of active utilities trying to buy uranium to secure their long-term needs. So what's happened in the spot market? The price has kind of corrected from a high of 106. We saw the market dip as low as $84, and right now we're sitting at 90. As soon as we hit 84, we saw buyers come back, nibble away. You know, we were able to raise capital, and we've been buying as well. I think we're at 750,000 pounds year to date. So we're nibbling away. We do have a little bit of cash, so that's a positive thing. So I would say the market in terms of activity has thinned out. I think most of it is because of price sensitivity and some reluctance to keep pushing the price higher. At the end of the day, the way I like to think of it is you only can kick the can down the road for so long. You need to come to market, whether that's in the spot market or in the term market, and you need to ensure you've got sufficient inventories so that your power station will never be at risk of ever not having fuel, which the industry is very good at ensuring that does not happen.
Well, let's shift to gold now. Obviously, very exciting times for precious metals investors. The gold bugs have been vindicated. We're at all-time highs, and unlike the end of last year where it just rose temporarily and came back down, it seems to be a sustained move. What are your thoughts on gold's rise here? Is this telling us something about the economy? And are we in the early stages of a long-term precious metals bull market? How high do you think we could go from here?
Yeah, well, I think you summed it up really nicely that gold is finally being vindicated, you know, after hitting an all-time high in, you know, the latter half of 2020 in US dollars. It really kind of went to sleep and was consolidating those gains in a tight range. I guess I'm gonna spray a whole bunch of kind of comments at you about it. What's interesting to us is that in every other currency, gold has hit an all-time high long ago. The holdout was US dollars. And let's face it, king dollar is still king dollar. But something has obviously shifted to waken gold up. And I would say it's two main catalysts. One, the Fed pivot in November of last year was very meaningful for gold. Now, the Fed has not cut rates yet, but the Fed has signaled that the tightening is done and that the next set of moves are going to be lower. And that's very important for gold. It, you know, there are $6 trillion sitting in U.S. money market funds alone. And so as rates start to normalize and come down over the next, let's say, 12 to 18 months, money is going to be on the move. And so I think that's important. We think the pivot was a clear kind of inflection point where gold started to behave better and move higher. Now, it's not just the Fed. We have seen a number of central banks basically signal they're done with their quantitative tightening and they're going to start to move to easing, which I think from a macro perspective is going to be very bullish for gold. The second main driver has been central banks acquiring huge amounts of gold over the last 2 years. And this is really being driven first and foremost by China. I used the term in an interview on Friday to describe the central bank buying by China as them having a voracious appetite. I'm going to use it again. But they really do. And really, what is this about? It's about a rotation away from U.S. treasuries to hard assets that they can store value with in their own country. I think governments around the world, let me correct my statement. Certain governments around the world that witnessed the freezing of Russian assets in 2022 had a bit of a wake-up call to say, if it's that easy for other nations to freeze hundreds of millions of dollars of our assets in the financial system, maybe we don't want to have all those assets in the financial system. So how do you take assets out of the financial system? Well, it's pretty easy. You exchange your dollars, you exchange your treasuries for gold, and you store the gold in your country. Nobody's freezing those assets. So if you think about what China's doing, I think this is part of a longer-term trend where they're basically rotating their enormous stockpile of U.S. treasuries, which they've been holding for a very long time. And as those treasuries mature, they're simply rotating the capital and putting it in physical gold. And we think this trend is going to continue. And the reason is simple. They are still sitting on a massive stockpile of U.S. treasuries. If you look at Chinese retail investors, they're doing kind of the similar thing. They're going back to the traditional cultural store of value, which is gold. And why? Well, because the real estate market, which clearly was a bubble, has burst. That store of value does not look as attractive to them. The stock market does not look like a great store of value because it's been a terrible performer for a number of years. And so we see Chinese retail investors going back to gold. And, you know, they're incredible savers and they have accumulated incredible wealth. So you've seen in China also the dual effect of not just the central bank buying, but also its citizens. And it's not just the Chinese central bank, the Indian central bank, Singapore central bank, the Turkish central bank, the Polish central bank. They've all been big buyers of gold over the last 2-3 years. And we do think this is a very concerted effort to diversify away from U.S. dollars in terms of their foreign exchange reserves. So we think this is really important. Now, at the same time, Western institutional investors have been absent. So as the price of gold has broken out over the last 6 months, they have continued to sell their gold holdings through their ETFs. And we look at all the ETFs globally as a proxy to gauge institutional interest in institutional holdings in physical gold. And with the exception of a few little green shoots we've seen in the last 2 weeks, they've been in net selling mode. So we chalk that up to basically disinterest and their gold basically going to China and other central banks. And if Western institutional investors just simply stopped selling their gold via the ETFs and actually started to, let's say, accumulate gold again, I think the gold rally would really get turbocharged here and you know, break ever new highs.
Now, central banks are not accumulating silver, but it has awoken from its slumber, consolidating sideways for a few years. Now, basically moving in tandem with gold, at least it appears to be. A lot of people I've spoken to say that silver generally tends to play catch up in the latter stages of a precious metals bull market. It seems to be performing a little bit differently this time around. I'm wondering what you think is driving the price action of silver and what it would take to get that medal back to all-time highs?
Yeah, great question. So you're absolutely right. I mean, silver, because it is a hybrid metal, meaning it has a monetary role and it has an industrial role, does not behave the same as gold. Gold is usually the first mover. And within a few months, you see silver typically move and then kind of slingshot buy gold is a typical pattern. You don't really see gold, you know, having these explosive moves, but you often see silver have these big moves. So what's driving silver right now? We see two things driving silver and a few things holding back silver. As you mentioned, central banks don't hold silver. It's just too voluminous to hold, you know, huge quantities of wealth. And we know because we store billions of dollars of silver, and we know how hard it is to vault it and to move it around. So we don't have the benefit of central banks also accumulating silver like they are with gold. But where silver is getting a lift right now is twofold. One, silver is increasingly being used for energy transition and clean energy technologies. And the most notable, obviously, is solar panels. So about 14% of all the silver in the world each year is consumed in solar panels. And China, just to give you some perspective, China built more solar capacity last year than the rest of the world over the last 4 years combined. And so I think it's fair to say that China is consuming, like gold, but for a different purpose, larger, ever larger amounts of silver because it is the most conductive or one of the most conductive metals in the world. And it is very important in terms of how it excites electrons in these solar panels. And so we see an ever increasing amount of silver being used for solar. We also see that. So that's the big industrial use for silver. Now let's flip over to the monetary side. Where we see big increases of silver demand is from Indian investors. India is importing huge amounts of silver, not for industrial uses, for store of wealth purposes. And we see this pattern over and over again. When the price of gold goes to new highs, you definitely see an increased substitution effect in India where they can no longer afford gold and they substitute to silver, which is obviously a fraction of the price. And we've seen record imports of silver into India. Now, let's flip to Western institutional investors for silver. Well, unlike gold, institutional investors right now are not overly excited about silver. They just don't own it to the same degree as silver. And if you just look at the billions of dollars that are held in gold ETFs globally versus the amount in silver, it's a very small number in silver. We see that with our own client base. Institutional investors just have, I'd say, way more interest and affinity for holding gold in their portfolio as a hedge versus holding silver as more of a speculative investment. And retail investors in terms of silver, while they are very strong believers and accumulators of silver, they've largely kind of been muted the last few years as silver, you know, tried to break through $30 back in 2021 and obviously hit, I think $18 was the cyclical low. And now we're kind of at $28 again. And we're really, I think, looking for a confirmation and breakout through $30 to confirm, you know, we're in this new market. I think what will ultimately push it up into new highs is we need, I think, greater institutional interest. We need the return of retail investors. Because we're not going to have that central bank buying like you do in gold. So those are the two investor groups. The silver, in terms of its industrial use, we think is just going to keep getting, you know, higher and higher. But, you know, going back to silver, I mean, gosh, silver at the end of 2010 was at $50 an ounce and we're at 28. You know, it's one of the few commodities that is nowhere near its all-time high. And so we still think silver has the potential to go for a run here if, you know, more catalysts kind of line up behind it.
Interesting. Let's shift to copper now, another metal that's been doing very well this year. We saw a lot of reports in 2022 and 2023 that there is a massive lack of supply in the face of growing demand. This looks like it's playing out the way that those reports had stated. Obviously, it takes a very long time to bring a new copper mine online, and it's extraordinarily expensive. We're seeing a lot of jurisdictional risk, political risk, the Cobre Panama mine, obviously, being basically stalled by the government there, massive copper project. We're seeing a lot of issues with jurisdictional risk in a lot of different countries for mining in general. This all seems to be very bullish for the price of copper. How do you see it positioned? Is this a bull market that's just getting started?
Yeah, great intro to copper. And obviously, we've been talking about copper for the last year and a bit. We launched our first copper mining ETF in February of 2023 because we started to see the market shifting. We started looking at the signals. We started to hear the major copper company, or excuse me, the major mining companies signaling, whether they were a diversified mining company or a gold miner, all signal they wanted to bulk up their copper exposure. We thought that was really interesting. And I think they're all signaling that because they see the long-term trajectory of copper, which is going to be very important as we move to this world of greater electrification and copper intensity. And if you think about the technologies that people are moving towards from a clean energy perspective, and if you just look at the expectations for energy consumption, they're all going up. And copper is kind of the common thread and backbone with everything to do with electrification. And it's not just about clean energy technologies. There's really two main drivers here. I think the largest driver is increasing energy consumption as countries acquire more wealth. If you think about the per capita energy consumption in an emerging market, it's incredibly low relative to the way you and I live. And it's quite simple. You don't have an air conditioner. You don't have all these appliances, et cetera, et cetera. You have very low energy intensity in your lifestyle. You know, as countries grow wealth and individuals accumulate wealth, you see greater energy consumption. You see greater, I would say, metal intensity because, you know, they buy things, they own things, cars, things like that. So the emerging markets, as they continue to grow wealth, are going to consume more electricity, and that consumption of electricity is going to be very mineral intensive. And then in the West and in more developed countries, we do have the challenge of increased electricity consumption, albeit much slower. But the focus has really been on adding electricity sources to the grid that have cleaner carbon footprints. And that is obviously everything from solar and wind farms, electric vehicles, nuclear energy. All of these things obviously require more grid transmissions, electrification. But it's even things like heat pumps as we move away from, you know, natural gas boilers to heat pumps. All these things are more energy copper intensive. So we see a wave of different sources of incremental demand coming for copper. And at the same time, the supply side of the story has been constrained. It's been constrained by a lot of different factors. One, I would say first and foremost, is we've been mining the copper for 5,000 plus years. So we've been really good at finding all the easy stuff. So I think that's the most important thing. Two, we haven't really developed a lot of new projects for a long time because for many years, the price of copper was kind of uninteresting. And when you have a lack of investment in a mining sector or a capital intensive sector, we know what happens is it's very hard to generate that supply response, just like I talked about earlier with uranium. So we see some parallels between the two. The copper mines, unlike things like gold and silver mines, tend to be really large scale. And they have very long lives. And so the upfront investment in bringing these projects online are enormous. It's not unheard of to have a $10 to $15 billion capex to develop a new copper mine. Now, that copper mine might produce ore for 30 or 40 years, but it's a huge upfront cost. And I can tell you, investors and companies are not going to make those upfront investments to that scale with a copper price that's not attractive enough to generate the returns on investment that these companies and investors are demanding. So, you know, at $4 a pound for copper, that's great. That's a good price for today's, I think, copper mining companies. They have very healthy margins. But in terms of like the greenfield projects that we need to bring online in the coming years, you know, they all are saying the same thing. It's not $4 that's gonna make it happen. It's probably five and six and maybe even higher. So, you know, we think over time the copper price is gonna slowly, you know, grind up to those types of price points to ensure we've got long-term security supply. So we're becoming very constructive on copper. It's a much more mature market because we've been mining it for thousands of years. It's obviously a very large market. You know, we produce over 25 million metric tons a year. So it's much bigger in size and scale and dollars. So you're not going to get, I think, the explosive kind of changes in price that you see with some of the minor metals and more of the nascent industries, such as lithium. And uranium is, let's say, a $15 billion a year market versus a $200 billion market for copper. So it's going to be, I think, more of your slow and steady. But we think ultimately the price is higher.
One of the trends and themes that has been out there is this rotation of capital from what many see as an overvalued broad market, the Magnificent Seven, into hard assets in the form of commodities, a commodity super cycle, as many are calling it. Do you see things that way? What are your thoughts? Do you think the broad market could rise along with commodities? Do you think we will see this sort of sector rotation? Because every time you think that NVIDIA, for example, is overvalued, it just seems to go higher. The S&P and the NASDAQ seem to keep grinding higher with a few blips along the way. What are your thoughts on that thesis of a rotation from tech stocks into commodities?
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. I would say that we don't need people to stop buying tech stocks or investing in tech stocks for a commodity super cycle to commence and last for many years. And the reason for that is that the amount invested today in commodities is so tiny versus historical levels. And it's so tiny, I think, first and foremost, because many commodity markets went through 10-year bear markets. So if you have a 10-year bear market in nickel or copper or uranium, why would capital want to go there? There's lots of other alternatives in the world, and capital left. Now, at some point, you can only kick the can down the road for so long. You run mines down, you come to end of life, you run down inventories, whatever the case may be. And then you have an inflection point. And if you ask us at Sprott, the inflection point's already happened. The inflection point, I believe, happened 2 years ago when the world basically made significant commitments to decarbonization, which are very mineral intense. And second of all, the second catalyst was the energy crisis that we had in 2022 after the war in Ukraine. And the world woke up and said, oh my gosh, our energy systems are incredibly vulnerable to shocks. And that has obviously been a very powerful catalyst to a whole host of, again, mineral intensive policies and strategies that we do not think are a 1 or 2 quarter blip. We think this is a 1 or 2 decade trend that is just underway. And if institutional investors just start to allocate tiny bits of capital into the sector, you could have an incredible impact because the sector is so under-owned right now. And it takes time for investors to come back. I can tell you, like, you know, I'll be very candid. You know, we would have institutional meetings, you know, 3 years ago or 4 years ago. And if you brought the word up, if you brought up the, you know, let's talk about commodities, you, like, and sometimes in the meetings, they'd literally stop and say, whoa, no, I don't want to talk about any of that stuff. Like, I got so burned in the last cycle, the sector's dead, I'm not interested in that, all these other things are working in my portfolio. It literally meant career risk for these people. They just did not want to touch it or even talk about it. Now, fast forward, and I can tell you in the last 2 to 3 years at Sprott, the amount of institutions that we engage with on a daily and weekly and monthly basis is unbelievable. Never in the company's history have we engaged with as many institutions that we do week in and week out. And they are all interested in learning about commodities. Now, I'm not saying it's across the board in every commodity, but the renewed interest in commodities is really powerful. And I just chalk it up to a few things. One, we're in a new bull market. So that's thing one, because if there are no returns, then nobody cares. Second of all, they've finally realized how mineral intensive these shifts are going to be, whether it's clean energy, decarbonization, energy security, reshoring, bringing manufacturing back to local soil, et cetera, et cetera. And they are seeing, they're connecting the dots, they're doing their work, but some of them are starting off, I can tell you, at very low levels of knowledge. And the reason is simple. They haven't invested in the sector for 10 or 12 years. So you're like, okay, let's, you know, my job, most weeks is I do teach-ins. It's like, let's do copper 101. Let's do uranium 101 today. And so, you know, sometimes I'm like, oh gosh, aren't we past this point? But it's important. And we spend enormous amounts of time talking to institutions, recording podcasts, doing webcasts, writing research reports, because there's a real thirst for knowledge and information, and there's interest. And so we want to capitalize on that. We're obviously incentivized to do that because we run billions of dollars in funds that are focused on gold, silver, platinum, palladium, uranium, copper, other metals that we're invested in, mining stocks, private investments that we do, private loans, private royalties and streams. So, you know, we're just immersed in the ecosystem that brings us incredible insights and knowledge, and we're more than happy to share it with people. If they invest with us, great. If they don't, that's fine too. But it's a process. It's a cycle. And what I think what has us excited is that these cycles do not last 2 or 3 years. They last way longer than a typical economic cycle. Commodity cycles can last 10 or 12 years. And if we're in kind of year 2 or 3, well, you know, we're pretty excited about the runway ahead of us.
Absolutely. Well, it's been a fantastic conversation, John. I'm going to put a link below to the suite of Sprott's ETFs. Is there anything you could shed light on about Sprott's activities? Anything new you're up to? Obviously, the Copper Fund is fairly recent. That's quite exciting. Maybe if you want to talk a little bit about that or anything else you think should be on people's radars when it comes to Sprott.
Yeah, well, we've been incredibly busy the last few years and you know, trying to position ourselves and provide very compelling and differentiated offerings using our knowledge in mining and metal to bring, you know, physical commodity funds to market, passive indexes that really, you know, integrate a lot of our knowledge, and as well as active strategies, everything from in the mining sectors to physical commodities as well. So we've been very focused. We've invested a lot of our own capital as well. And, you know, and we're launching products, not just in the US and Canada, but we've also partnered with Han ETF in Europe to bring some of these strategies to European clients who, you know, are always clamoring and chasing us on Twitter to, you know, please bring this fund to Europe for us. And, you know, we're doing our best now that we have uranium miners, the junior uranium miners. We've got our copper miners that just launched there, and as well as our broader energy transition materials. So we've now got 4 offerings in Europe, as well as an ever-growing suite of funds listed in North America. And we're not done. We're constantly looking for new ideas. But, you know, we're very selective. We want to make sure the strategies make sense. Are we willing to put our own capital in them? Do they have a compelling story? Can we provide a differentiated offering? But first and foremost, you know, as you said, it's about educating yourself, making informed decisions, understanding what you're investing in, what you own. And we really encourage people to come to our websites, read our white papers, listen to our podcasts, sign up for our webcasts, you know, learn and be informed. So that would be my parting message.
Great. I will put a link below, as I said, to Sprott's ETFs. Also a bit of a plug for the Sprott Money podcast. My good friend Craig Hemke hosts that wonderful program as well. So I encourage people to check that out. And thank you once again, John, for coming on and sharing your knowledge with the audience.
Thank you. Always great to chat with you, Jesse.
Commodity Culture is a podcast that covers investing in commodities and natural resources. If you'd like to hear more, be sure to subscribe so you are always alerted of the latest episodes.